Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, September 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, what Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are saying as they are back on the campaign trail.
We're going to have a Trump administration that's going to get things done.
President Obama heading to Israel for the funeral of Shimon Peres. The best way to survive the world's second leading cause of death. Also ahead, a monumental moment for a musical icon.
This album influenced the sound of R&B and soul music and pop music and funk music.
It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on Wednesday headed to political battleground states. They need to win in the November 11th or 8th election. Clinton campaigned in the northeastern state of New Hampshire with her one-time rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, as she looks to woo younger voters. First Lady Michelle Obama campaigned for Clinton in yet another important state, Pennsylvania, where she referenced Donald Trump's accusation that Clinton doesn't have the stamina to be president.
And for those who question her stamina to be president, Hillary's resilience is more than proven. As she said on Monday night, she's the only candidate in this race who has traveled to 112 countries, who's negotiated a ceasefire, a peace agreement, a release of dissidents, who spent 11 hours testifying before a congressional committee. Hillary is tough. And when she gets knocked down, she doesn't complain. She doesn't cry foul. No, she gets back up.
Trump appeared at rallies in Chicago, Iowa, and Wisconsin, where he continued to criticize his opponent.
We're going to have a Trump administration that's going to get things done, that's going to lower taxes. Hillary Clinton, who I happen to believe is grossly incompetent, by the way, I just feel she's grossly incompetent, but Hillary Clinton is going to increase taxes.
Well, joining me now for more analysis on the election is Politico campaign reporter Kyle Cheney. Kyle, what's your overall take on where things stand following Monday night's debate?
Well, I think there's been a pretty clear and decisive reaction from the public, which is that Hillary Clinton won that first debate. And that means in the sense that she just seemed better prepared, she seemed more like she was speaking clearly and cogently on some of the issues. And Trump seemed, at least after a strong start, to come apart a little bit and react to a lot of Clinton's barbs and attacks at him. So that's the general sense that we're getting, and I think his team is scrambling to prepare for the next debate to ensure that doesn't happen again.
It's my understanding they are talking about actually having him prepare and do mock debates.
Right, and I think that was the thing. They kind of almost boastfully said, oh, we don't have to prepare and sit there and do mock debates and do all this briefing books and all that. Trump is good on his own. That's what's carried him all the way to this point. But I think now they're saying, well, we better do a quick 180 on that and try to make sure that doesn't happen again in front of that huge type of audience.
But just because his campaign managers would like to see that happen, we've heard in the past that he doesn't always listen to them.
Right. I think, and that's where some of the anxiety comes in on their part. They think they know what they have to do. The question is, you know, look, Trump's in charge of his campaign. He says it all the time. He's the number one guy. If he doesn't want to do that, he's not going to do that. He may want to go to rallies and hear from people who love him and not necessarily sit in a room full of briefing books.
And, of course, we know the people that love him are sticking with him. He can do no wrong. But really, right now, he needs to expand his base.
And that's the issue here, is that that's what it's about for him right now. He needs a campaign of addition and not just maintaining who he's got. And so I think that's why the debate was so one-sided. He didn't really do much to reach out to those voters, the suburban Republican women, moderate or swing voters that he needs to carry him to victory.
He's back out on the campaign trail. He's talking about how he's saying he won the debate, and he's also back on the attack on Hillary Clinton and her health and her stamina.
Right. In some ways, it's the exact problem that he's had. He's sort of whipping his base up into a frenzy, which he loves. I mean, he loves being in those rooms, and he gets the adulation and the cheers for those kind of lines. But again, that doesn't help him expand that base of voters. They're not moved by the red meat stuff. You know, I think that's a crutch for him in some ways, especially after the night he had on Monday.
The next debate in about a week and a half from now. The format is a lot different. It's more of a town hall style where people will be actually able to ask the candidates questions. Right. Do you think there's one candidate that type of format might favor?
I think in general, you have to say that Clinton comes in as a favorite because of how she did in the first debate. It's also just the year, the decade of experience in those kinds of settings. Trump he's done town halls on CNN where he gets voter questions, but when you picture these debates, if the candidates are walking around, there's a lot of body language involved that Trump hasn't necessarily been familiar or comfortable with. So, again, it has to favor her. And the question is that the kind of prep they're going to be doing over the next 10 days or so?
I would think that the candidates would be doing less sort of interacting with each other and going after each other. So, in a way, that would take maybe some of the pressure off, or is it just sort of different?
You'd think, because he took a little bit of heat for how much he interrupted Clinton, and there'll be a little less of that, a little more directing your answers to the voters. So that's possible, but Clinton's definitely going to want to try to rile him up the same way she did in the first debate. And so how does he handle that? Does interrupting really work in the town hall format the same way? And so that may be something she tries to exploit.
And Hillary Clinton, another big advantage for her, she has all these high-profile surrogates that are really out there now campaigning and appealing to young voters, to going to universities. You've got President Obama, you've got Michelle Obama, you've got Vice President Biden, you've got Bernie Sanders out on the campaign trail.
Liz Warren and so many others, she's got this huge cast she can turn to when she wants to step off the trail and prepare in some ways, too. That's one of the overlooked things about why she was able to prepare so easily. Her husband, Bill Clinton, can step out on the trail for her, too. The Republicans don't have someone with that kind of draw, and maybe Mitt Romney, and he's obviously not in the Trump camp, so he doesn't have a bench like that.
But do surrogates matter? Can they actually change an outcome? Can they convince undecided voters?
They're never as effective as the candidate. That will never be the case. Bill Clinton may have the draw of a president, or Barack Obama is the president, but he can't make the case for her the way she can. It absolutely helps. It draws news coverage. It gets headlines when these type of people come into town, and that's what she needs.
Well, that's Politico campaign reporter Kyle Chaney. Thank you so much. U.S. presidential elections, by the way, are not decided by a national popular vote, but rather by individual races in the 50 states, with each state's importance in the overall outcome weighted by its population. Turning now to our social media segment with G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. What's going on?
Hi, Lori. So it looks like there are changes coming to American bank Wells Fargo. The financial institution is in the hot seat for a systematic cross-selling of as many as 2 million unauthorized accounts. So that means the bank aimed to get each customer to open up to 8 different accounts to make its shares more attractive to investors. Most people usually need up to 2 different accounts at a bank, right? A savings and a checking account. The Senate Banking Committee recently had a hearing about it, which we talked about on our show. And on Wednesday, the bank announced it will claw back $41 million from its CEO, John Stumpf. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren played an integral role at the hearing.
Right. So the bank will actually recover as a penalty some of the money already disbursed to him?
That's right.
What is Warren saying about it?
Well, she's still calling for more accountability. Warren sent out these tweets Wednesday. She wrote, "This is a small step in the right direction, but nowhere near real accountability." She also wrote, "As I said last week, Mr. Stumpf should resign, return every nickel he made while the scam was ongoing, and face SEC and DOJ investigations." Now, during the hearing, Stumpf actually said he disagrees with it being labeled as a scam. Warren is on Twitter at Senator Warren, that's S-E-N Warren. Wells Fargo is also on Twitter at Wells Fargo, but its latest tweet is from more than a week ago.
Okay, well, what else are people talking about?
Yet another development in the mobile handset industry. BlackBerry smartphones are no more.
Really?
I know. Do you remember the time when everyone had a BlackBerry?
Yes, I never had one.
I see. Well, the Canadian tech firm posted a $372 million quarterly loss, which led to that decision. Social media users are writing that it's an end of an era.
Indeed it is. The iPhone has taken over.
I see that too. That's all for me today. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. plans to deploy 615 more troops to Iraq. Malawi girls are learning self-defense tactics against sexual abuse. Meltwater lakes in Antarctica, a sign of big trouble. And the U.S. pushes for more elephant and rhino protection at home and abroad. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And we continue now with the White House announcing that President Barack Obama will lead a U.S. delegation to Jerusalem to attend the funeral on Friday of Shimon Peres. Obama is among a high-powered group of global leaders and dignitaries expected to attend the ceremony, including former President Bill Clinton. Peres's life of public service spans the life of the Israeli nation itself. His son, Shemi, conveyed news last night.
Today, with deep sorrow, we bid farewell to our beloved father, the ninth president of Israel, Shimon Peres. He was one of the founding fathers of the State of Israel and served our people before we even had a country of our own. He worked tirelessly for Israel from the very first day of the state to the last day of his life.
Secretary of State John Kerry will also be attending the funeral and talked about the legacy Peres leaves.
Shimon Peres will be hugely missed. A great gap exists now. And everybody who knew him, admired him, who was inspired by him, and by his example for the pursuit of justice and peace, will continue, I know, to remain inspired and motivated by him.
Well, at every corner of Israel's tumultuous history, Shimon Peres was there. He held nearly every major Israeli political post during his long career. His major achievement, by the way, was as foreign minister with the Oslo Accords, a deal for Palestinian self-rule, which for him, then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat shared the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize. Peres died Tuesday at the age of 93, 2 weeks after suffering a severe stroke. And stroke, meanwhile, is the second leading cause of death worldwide and the third leading cause of disability, according to the World Health Organization. But as VOA's Carol Pearson tells us, a new study finds that the faster a stroke victim is treated, the better their chances are for recovery.
Researchers from the University of California, Los Angeles, wanted to find out what window of time could provide the best recovery rate for stroke patients, along with which treatment also worked best. So they reviewed the outcomes of more than 1,200 patients experiencing acute ischemic stroke, a stroke in a major artery that cuts off the blood supply to the brain. Some patients received standard clot-breaking medicine, and others received that, plus a thrombectomy, a procedure using a tool that pulls clots out of an artery. Their findings: the sooner the patient had a thrombectomy, the better the overall recovery. Dr. Jeffrey Saver is the director of the Comprehensive Stroke Center at the University of California, Los Angeles, also known as UCLA.
Time makes a big difference. Every 4 minutes that goes by after a patient gets to the hospital, one fewer out of 100 patients has a good outcome if the artery hasn't been opened.
Blood clots in major arteries cause blood to stop flowing to the brain, and without a blood supply, the brain cells begin to die, which is why time is of the essence when treating a stroke.
If you get the artery open at 3 hours, then 65% of patients will be able to live independently 3 months later. If it takes 8 hours to get it open, then only 45% will be able to live independently. It makes a major difference in outcome.
Saver said it is critical for everyone to know the signs of stroke: facial drooping, arm weakness, and difficulty with speech. When these symptoms appear, it's critical to get emergency care.
Often the patient can't make the call themselves because the stroke's affecting their speaking or their ability to recognize they're having a stroke.
The study was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. Some researchers say the study may change the treatment stroke patients receive when they first come into the hospital. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. If you are an animal lover, you will love this next story. Some big changes in the United States for our closest living relatives. Hundreds of chimpanzees who have never touched grass or swung from a tree are moving out of biomedical laboratories where they've endured invasive experiments and into sanctuaries. I'm joined now by Laura Bonner, Chief Program and Policy Officer for the Animal Protection of New Mexico, whose group has been instrumental in working toward these changes. Laura, tell us about it.
It is an exciting time because finally the United States has stopped paying for the continued use of chimpanzees in invasive testing, which was very cruel for the chimps themselves, but also we know scientifically it was not beneficial for human health. So finally that has ended, and now we are seeing a big movement of chimps entering sanctuary. It's tremendously exciting. In particular, there's a group of 19 chimps. They were all held in New Mexico, where I live at one point, but we were fighting to protect these chimps who were held at a Texas lab, and all of them finally reached sanctuary this spring. So it's really a celebratory time. At the same time that we're celebrating, we are also trying to ramp up the ability of sanctuaries to take in additional chimpanzees, because there's still about 650 chimps in labs across the United States. They're not being tested on, but they are waiting for their chance to go to sanctuary.
And they're not being tested on anymore because of the law?
They're not being tested on anymore because of a variety of things that happened. Tremendous public pressure caused Congress to ask for an independent study on whether or not we needed chimps in research. This was in 2010. That study came back and found that the way that the government was testing on chimps was not beneficial for human health in almost every case. And then the National Institutes of Health, who own several hundred chimps, quote-unquote, they own about 300 chimpanzees in these labs, they developed new guidelines to try to use chimps in research, but then no one even came close to finding a research protocol that fit these new guidelines. And then the last nail in the coffin ending the use of chimpanzees in invasive research was when our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service classified chimpanzees in captivity as endangered. So that gives them significant protections from any harm. And it's not law. It is multiple policies that are protecting these chimps from being used in any more testing.
You've already got a group that are already in sanctuary, and it looks to me like you're trying to now secure more sanctuary space or more sanctuaries in general in the United States for the remaining chimps?
That's right. It's a very unique situation when, you know, with other animal issues, oftentimes you're looking at the populations, say, of dogs and cats who need homes, who are in animal shelters. That number is very high. But this population of chimps is only about 650. I say only, but they're all individuals. Many of them have really lived through a lot of trauma in their lives because, you know, at human hands because of their use in testing. So we have a population of chimps that's not growing because there's no more breeding of chimps in labs. It's actually, we have many chimps who are elderly, and some some who are sick and dying. So it's a bit of a race now to see how many chimps we can help get to sanctuary. There are a handful of very high-quality accredited sanctuaries here in the United States capable of taking these chimps, but they need more support to continue taking the individuals. One of the things that my organization, Animal Protection of New Mexico, has done to help is we created a chimpanzee sanctuary fund, and we're raising funds and making grants to sanctuaries to take more chimps. We're getting ready to announce another grant cycle this fall, and we hope to see a big group of chimpanzees move later this year. There's a new sanctuary that's opened up to help take chimps.
Where's that?
That's in Georgia. It's called Project Chimps. And Chimp Haven is a federal sanctuary in Louisiana. They've really doubled in size and taken in like 130, 140 chimps in recent years.
It's interesting because, you know, you've got chimpanzees in the wild, like in parts of Africa, where they're in jeopardy due to poaching.
Yeah.
And then here in the United States, we're so environmentally conscientious that we think that's just a horrific thing to go out there and kill chimps, and yet, you know, we've got these labs filled with creatures that are so close to our own DNA.
That's right. And, you know, it's so interconnected. I mean, why are there chimpanzees in New Mexico? It's because the U.S. Air Force brought 65 chimpanzees from Africa to New Mexico in the 1950s, 1960s for use in testing prior to manned spaceflight. So these issues between the survival of chimpanzees in the wild and how we treat chimpanzees here in the United States in captivity are totally linked. In fact, when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service classified chimp in captivity here as endangered, I mean, gosh, that was just last year. That meant before then, it made it even easier for this trade, this illicit trade of chimpanzees, you know, some of them so violent. If you imagine a baby chimpanzee being taken from its family in the wild, that means that multiple adult members of that family are being killed, if not the entire band, just to get one baby chimp to take into captivity. So it's very perilous for chimps in the wild. Their survival is really, you know, and that's at human hands. We have to take responsibility for that. And I think the United States, when we stop the use of chimps in invasive testing, when we put these stronger protections around chimps in captivity here in the United States, that only supports chimps in the wild because, again, we're a big economy here and we've taken away that economic incentive here in the United States, at least, to continue treating chimps like just a commodity. We're recognizing now that we have an ethical obligation to them, and obviously many more things need to change for chimps in the wild and for all animals, and we have to keep going.
All right. Well, we sure do appreciate all you've done. Laura Bonner, Chief Program and Policy Officer for the Animal Protection of New Mexico. Thanks for being with us. Well, it has been 40 years since American musical icon Stevie Wonder's groundbreaking album, Songs in the Key of Life, was released. International Edition's David Byrd talked about it with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the album and how it's still breaking ground 40 years later.
I mean, I think this is one of those albums where you start with the first track on the first album or first CD, and you go all the way through until the end. I don't think there's a miss there. Now, I think it's also important to remember that this song or this album was released in 1976. And if you use that context and listen to it now, 40 years later, it'll be interesting to see and to hear that the more things change, the more they stay the same, but also musically how this album influenced the sound of R&B and soul music and pop music and funk music and continues to do so to this day. We hear it sampled in hip hop songs that are popular today. And of course, I mean, ask any soul artist, any R&B artist, any country artist today. They'll probably tell you that Stevie Wonder was a huge influence on their work.
And some of the tunes that people might recognize off of this, I Wish, Sir Duke.
Isn't
She Lovely?
Which featured his daughter, who had just been born not too soon before.
Yeah, and all of these are, you know, when you say Stevie Wonder, like if you were to do a catalog, like
right.
Frank Sinatra had the Columbia years or what, if you were to do a catalog, the tunes on this album would be the names that would come up first.
Right. Or Dave, if you were to do a playlist, because that's what we're doing now. If you're going to do your digital playlist.
Sorry. I'm old.
These will be the songs on your Stevie Wonder playlist. Absolutely. But, I mean, one of my favorite songs on this project is Pastime Paradise. And I remember this album. I was very young when it was released. I was a baby. But the album was always in our home. We had the actual vinyl. We had the tape, the cassette tape.
The 8-track? No.
No, we didn't have an 8-track. But we had the cassette tape. And then I bought the CD when I was in college. And I still have both the vinyl and the CD. It was that important to me growing up in Detroit, me having parents who were really big into the sound of Motown, and then also what was going on in the world, social justice. And if you grew up in a time or around people who were concerned about what was going on in the world, it was Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and it was Songs in the Key of Life. Like, those two albums you had to have. And so I remember Pastime Paradise, and then I remember many years later, Coolio sampled that song and it became a huge hit with his Gangster's Paradise. So again, as I say, this album has influenced urban music and even pop music for the last 40 years.
Well, how about you? Do you have a favorite Stevie Wonder tune from Songs in the Key of Life? Let us know. You can hit Shauna up. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA One The Hits. And you can always log on to our website and find the Soul Lounge there. That's at voanews.com.
Well, that is going to wrap up today's show, but you can join us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is very concerned over the situation in Ethiopia, particularly the instability in the Oromia and Amhara regions, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield said in an interview. Speaking in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting, Assistant Secretary Thomas Greenfield called the response by the government to protests an intense and somewhat harsh crackdown.
We have had discussions with the Ethiopian government encouraging that they have dialogue and that they open the possibility for press freedom, civil society's ability to function, and that many of the people who have been put in jail.
In Oromia, anti-government protests began in November 2015, and they have also occurred in the northern Amhara region. Assistant Secretary Thomas Greenfield said the United States believes that the situation in the country could deteriorate and that the Ethiopian government is aware of that possibility as well.
We've met with Prime Minister Haile Mariam here in New York, and we have encouraged him to look at how the government is addressing this situation.
We think, she said, it could get worse if it's not addressed sooner rather than later.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
is for what's the universe?